Thank you. I also thank the organizers for inviting me. I've been requested to talk about positrons, which doesn't quite fit what we talked about just before the coffee break, but that nevertheless is a topic that has received a tremendous attention in the past year. And it all started with this spectrum here. This is actually all electrons, electrons plus positrons, measured by a balloon experiment called ATTIC. And those are the data points here. This is the differential number spectrum times E cubed, so that we actually see something. And we're looking at 100 or a few hundred GeV particle energies. And what you just expect from ordinary cosmic ray sources that induce something like a power loss spectrum is this dashed line. Yet what was seen is this. And the point is that there appeared to be an additional contribution of electrons and or positrons somewhere around here, which had to be very, very much peaked. And then whenever you show this to somebody who does particle physics, the first thing they worry about is dark matter. And so it was here. Now it has to be very peaked. And if you correct for the propagation of those electrons and positrons, you find that the injection must be close to monoenergetic. And there are models that can provide that for Kaluza-Klein dark matter. So now you're at extra dimensions. So you can imagine that this is even more interesting in the particle physics community. One drawback is that for all reasonable cross-sections, the signal has to be boosted considerably, and one way of doing this is clumping the dark matter. The other way of doing this is a little bit more speculative, perhaps. That's a particle physics effect called the Sommerfeld enhancement. At about the same time, maybe a month or so later, the Pamela collaboration published their results. Now, they have a different type of experiment, and that allows to distinguish between positrons and electrons. So what we're seeing here is the positron fraction of the total electron plus positron signal. You're doing that because once you do this, you don't need to understand your absolute efficiency of the detector. You only need to understand relative efficiency, much easier. Earlier experiments are all those dark data points. Here you see an overall trend of fall off with energy here, and then it gets somewhat controversial there. The red points are from Pamela, so they're somewhat low here, but then the positron fraction increases up to about 80 GeV. Again, you can work out what you expect, and what you expect is just based on ordinary hadronic cosmic rays in the galaxy doing inelastic collisions, and when they do this, they tend to produce pions, and the charged pions decay into secondary electrons and positrons. And you work this out, you get something like this line here. You can play around with the propagation a little bit, that changes exactly where the line is, but essentially all those expectations have it that the positron fraction should go down with energy. Yet what was seen was this. So again, this suggests that there is something out there that provides us with additional positrons. Okay, so what could this be? Well, that's the dark matter explanation, of course, and I already suggested the Kaluza-Klein interpretation. Now, the thing is that if you put the ATTIC result and the Pamela result together, you can kind of fit the two, by just having that same extra component that was dotted in before in the ATTIC spectrum, this kind of Kaluza-Klein after propagation. The problem with this is that you want to be really careful about the propagation effects here. So the dotted line I showed before was just for the homogeneous distribution of dark matter in the galaxy and then relatively basic propagation effects. But what we're really looking at here is an interplay of where I'm actually injecting those positrons in the galaxy, how they propagate, in particular what the energy dependence is of the diffusion coefficient, and then very severe energy losses most notably by synchrotron radiation. Typically, there are different classes of models that have different energy dependencies of the diffusion coefficient. One invokes reacceleration at lower energies, which, however, doesn't play any role for the energy range that we're talking about here for the positrons. All right. Now, if we're now doing this for dark matter that is annihilating, and we consider the required boosting as arising from clumping, then the following problem arises. We need to know what the mass spectrum is of those clumps. And people try to estimate this, and you find that very often the mass spectrum can be approximated by a power law, and that index here is typically around 2. The next thing is, what is the electron or positron production rate as a function of mass? That also very often is estimated as a power law, the power law index being about 1. So if you put this together and then write down, well, what's my electron-positron source rate per logarithmic mass interval? Now, this is the mass of the dark matter clump. And that also is a power law, but if you work out the indices and have these ballpark numbers, D1, B2, you see that this is somewhat flattish. It's somewhere around 0, this global exponent. And if it's somewhere around 0, it could be marginally positive and could be marginally negative. If it's negative, then it's indeed so that most of the positrons you would see from dark matter annihilation come from small mass clumps. They can have masses much smaller than a solar mass. And those are so many that essentially everything goes back to a homogeneous dark matter distribution. Whenever that index, however, is marginally positive, we're far away from that. And what I'm going to show you on the next slide are some propagation calculations that just have this index at plus 0.05. So really marginally positive. So there is certain preference for getting those extra positrons from a few massive clumps. And the important issue is, where is that clump? So let's look at this here. And I'm doing this just for two different parameter combinations. Both give this global power index of 0.005. What I'm doing here is I'm adding the local positron and electron signal from dark matter annihilation to the global spectrum of secondary electrons. So that's why at higher energies it continues as a power law. A little bit tough to see, presumably. There's a dotted line here. That's the dotted line, basically the same that we had in that first spectrum. That is Kaluza-Klein annihilation producing monoenergetic electrons and positrons, assuming the dark matter distribution is homogeneous. Just follows the overall galactic dark matter density profile. And that's the spectrum you're getting. But of course, that's not what I was intending to look at here. What I was intending to look at here is, what's the result if the situation gives me more positrons from the massive clumps? And the actual spectrum that I can see locally can vary a great deal. This solid line here is one example. That solid line here is another example. And if you just look at what the kind of fluctuation range is here, that's what's indicated by those reddish shaded areas here. So that's something like 50%, 90%, 99%. And you can see that the uncertainty can be huge. And this is maybe not necessarily a problem if you want to take this and estimate the dark matter properties, like the mass of the particle or the boosting factor, but it will be a problem, as we see in a moment, when you want to distinguish a dark matter signal from anything that's coming from other more conventional astrophysical sources. For example, a pulsar. You can do basically the same thing with the parser. And this, for this plot, I'm using only one parser. In a moment, I'm showing you what you get when you have many parsers, as we, of course, have in the galaxy. So parsers produce electron-positron pairs, some of which will leak. And we don't have a terribly good understanding of what the spectrum is of the leaking pairs, but there is some consensus that it is well approximated by a relatively hard power law and then some cutoff. And the cutoff energy is also not terribly well determined and may depend on how old the parser is. But let's just put this in. If I just draw this here, that's in fact the dotted line. And now again, we have that competition between propagation, energy-dependent propagation, and energy losses. And the entire problem can be written in dimensionless parameters, which for standard galactic numbers for the diffusion coefficient, magnetic field strength, et cetera, correspond to this zeta here of 1 corresponds to a time of about 140,000 years, and that distance parameter that I'm using here corresponds to a distance of about 700 parsecs. And indeed, within that time interval, you expect to have about one parser within that distance, approximately. So what you see is these are different spectra for different times here. You can actually produce something that's fairly narrow out of something that's broad, so that your local aspect of what this particular parser produces can mimic a very narrowly peaked spectrum, even though what the parser globally leaks out can have a much broader spectrum. It's really the energy losses that cut off at higher energies, and it's the energy-dependent diffusion that cuts out at lower energies. So those two conspire here. And what I've done here is I've taken three cases. One is the parser, and I've varied the parameters a little bit compared with the previous plot. One is what I expect from homogeneously distributed Kaluza-Klein dark matter. And the third one is what I expect from clumpy dark matter. It's actually one of those spectra that I calculated before that's in here. So one gives me this dotted blue line, the other one gives the dashed red line, and the last one gives the solid green line, and all after some 5% energy resolution. And if you can tell me which is which, you're actually pretty good. So if you see something like this in your data, it's extremely difficult to distinguish one from the other. I would posit that it's nearly impossible, even if you had perfect data. One of the reasons why that is so is that the underlying spectrum here, I've just taken as a power law, but we don't exactly know that it is a power law throughout. That can have structure as well. And that complicates things. So even though you can always imagine that there is a dark matter signal there, proving that is an extremely difficult affair. And you probably will want to have more than just a signal in, for example, your electron-positron spectra. Now, earlier this year, this plot was made public. What we're looking at here is the total electrons, so that's electrons plus positrons, measurement made with the Fermi-LAT experiment. Now, LAT originally, of course, was designed to measure gamma rays, but you actually do this by converting the gamma rays into electrons and positrons and then look at what they do in your detector. So in a way, you can use the LAT to directly look at electrons and positrons. You can't distinguish them, though. These are the old ATTIC data points, actually derived in two independent balloon flights. And those are the Fermi data points. The statistical error bars of the Fermi data points are really, really small, so you don't see them. And I will show some estimate of the systematic error bars in a minute. The point here is that those two experiments, or those two results, are clearly in conflict. The Fermi people, of course, posit that they understand the systematics of their instrument much better, and they would also be able, energy resolution-wise, to see a peak here, if it existed. So far, the Attic people also are holding their position. So my preference is with the Fermi data, but certainly, you know, we will need to look into this a little bit more. But it may well be that this peak here actually doesn't exist. Well, we're still having that Pamela positron excess, all right? So if that's an additional component, then whatever that is, it most likely no longer really continues and then produces some kind of peak here, but it has to roll off, and then it would do that somewhere around 200 GeV. Because otherwise, it would produce, you know, an observable signal in the total electron spectrum. All right, and here, as promised, the LAT spectrum with an estimate of the point-to-point systematic errors. Systematic errors come in all flavors, but many of them, for example, the absolute energy scale, just affect the spectrum as a whole and not the individual data points. And looking at that, you already have the impression that maybe, you know, the estimate here is a little bit conservative in terms of point-to-point errors. But anyway, so what we're having here in red are LAT data points. What I have in blue is sort of one half of the total electron spectrum measured with HESS, an atmospheric Cherenkov telescope. They also have some data here, which I haven't plotted in, but there it also looks flat. The point I want to make here is that the LAT data can be very well fit by a single power law. But if we assume that those electrons overarchingly come from individual sources such as supernova remnants, there is only a finite number of supernova remnants that can actually contribute to the local signal. And the reason, again, is that there's the same energy losses, the same propagation effects that I mentioned before, that limit the local electron signal. Thank you. And if you work this out, and you can do this, you get all kinds of expected local bumpy features here, which are about as bumpy as the observed LAT data themselves. So there is really no evidence for any additional structure from individual sources that we see in those LAT data. And by the way, those propagation effects, of course, also impose quite a bit of uncertainty in deducing the propagation parameters. Now you can do the same with pulsars, and I've done this here. I'm taking basically the same source statistics globally, just say 20% or so of all supernovae, give me a pulsar and let them leak some. This is about what you're getting. Now this is sort of the average, but the fluctuations are huge, so you could see this. And this is adding up all pulsars that we identify and all pulsars that we don't identify in the sky. So there would be a broad bump, and I really wouldn't see very much up there. Okay, can we say a little bit more about dark matter? Yes, you can, but because you can still work out what the implications are of any interpretation of this positron signal as dark matter, and people do this. There are two ways of doing this. One is dark matter annihilation, and then you can look at what happens outside of the galaxy, in galaxy clusters, in other galaxies, etc., add this all up, and this is what Profumo and Yeltema, for example, did, and they find that there is too much background expected based on that. Some other people do this for our own galaxy, but then dark matter annihilation scales with the density squared. So you look at where the density is high, that's the galactic center region here. And you find that you're expecting something like this. This is now a GeV, 10 GeV, 100 GeV. And they only compared this with the EGRIT data because the Fermi-LAT results are not yet public for that. But this is actually fairly high. And what we've seen from the Fermilab so far at somewhat higher latitudes is that the diffuse emission measured with EGRIT was probably a little bit overestimated here. So the EGRIT GV excess doesn't seem to quite exist. So this will likely be already in conflict with the diffuse emission from the inner galaxy. And let me stress this point with the extragalactic emission a little bit more. This is a plot that the Fermilab collaboration showed at the International Cosmic Ray Conference a month or 2 months back. Their first step at the extragalactic diffuse emission. So here, that's the total signal, and then you model what's there in terms of sources, you model what's there in terms of diffuse emission, and there is an isotropic residual which actually looks pretty much like a power law here. And now you compare this what you would expect to get under certain circumstances. And the circumstance I'm talking about now is that the dark matter actually decays. Because then the dark matter signal just depends linearly on the density. So there's no strong enhancement of any gamma ray signal from the galactic center. Yet there is still an expectation from what you see from the galactic halo from Inverse Compton emission, and what you see from basically the dark matter throughout the universe. And that's a very solid estimate, because the dark matter just goes in globally, and I can use the WMAP data to basically derive this. So everything here is known really well. And what I'm expecting is already a factor two above this power law fit that the Fermilab collaboration presented 6 weeks ago. So all those dark matter interpretations are in real trouble concerning the inverse Compton emission you expect from those extra electrons and positrons. And let me conclude at that point. So there is this positron excess seen with Pamela. There is no corresponding excess, and I didn't show you the plot in the antiproton data. And if you take that serious, it can't extend much beyond 200 GeV. Otherwise, we would be in conflict with the Fermilab data of the electrons. We've looked into pulsars, dark matter annihilation, and decay here. And we've said that there are strong constraints from gamma ray signals on annihilation. There are also strong constraints on dark matter decay. There are some other possibilities that have been floated in a couple of papers recently. One is that the positrons are basically produced near supernova remnant shocks and then further accelerated. Before I put too much credit into this, I would really like to see a similar calculation for boron and carbon and what that does for the boron and carbon ratio, so that that is not in conflict with the data when you want to explain the positron data. So overall, I'd say the pulsar scenario is the least uncomfortable. Let me put it this way. It's the one that gives me the least stomach pain. And as one study also found out, so if you work all this out and look at the radio emission, the synchrotron emission from these particles, it even fits the WMAP haze. So that's nice. And my last slide is just addressing the younger people in the audience. If there's some that still need a new postdoc, then they should talk with me, because I have some, but they should do fast, because I have a 7 o'clock flight out of Los Angeles today, so do this over lunch. Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions. So if you go back to your slide where you look at the sort of summed up signal of all pulsars, it looked like you actually took one cutoff energy for all the pulsars. Is this correct?
Correct.
So I remember some earlier papers before the Fermi data came out that actually made a big noise because the cutoff might be different from each pulsar and so on, that this would actually imply some substructure given the in the total electron spectrum given the sensitivity of Fermi. Can you comment on this?
First of all, it's just the propagation and the finite number of pulsars that contributes here that already gives substantial substructure, right? So, you know, you can have a spectrum that looks like this, and there's a little bump, there's a little bump. We're already having that, okay? And the other thing is, if there is some kind of extended range of cutoff energies, people also presume that that actually changes over with time for the individual pulsar. That basically just smears out this bump here a little bit, okay? But the problem is, if you know, this is a superposition of all, and this is what you expect from one individual one. So it's very hard to take one individual parser and have that make a strong contribution and not being completely wiped out by all the other parsers. So that's something you really have to consider when you look into this.
There was another question. Basically, regarding Kaluza-Klein interpretation,
yes.
You said that's the only possibility to fit the Eddig spectrum. Well, in principle, if you have a leptophilic supersymmetric decay, then you can also actually produce a sort of sharpish feature there. That might not be maybe as sharp, but at least since the Eddig data is now a little bit in conflict with Fermi data, I remember some papers that actually have been able to fit a leptophilic decay model to the data and also at the same time be able to explain the Pamela excess.
I didn't say that Kaluza-Klein was the only one that gives you nearly monoenergetic electrons positive, but that's the one that got most of the traction initially.
Yeah, I would like to comment. There was a work, I think a couple of months ago, with Svipi Ran and I think also Udi Nakkar, that claimed that the excess can be easily explained by the fact that the sources are not isotropically distributed, as massive theories assume, but by the fact that sources are likely connected to the galactic arm. And so if you consider this anisotropy in the distribution of the sources, then the claim was that this excess is actually pretty much expected. So I would like to ask you to comment on that.
This range of fluctuation here comes from the sources not being homogeneous. All right, this is already in there, and people have, well, I actually did it 10 years ago, just for the ordinary electron spectrum, have also tried this with spiral arms, no spiral arms. It doesn't really make a lot of difference whether you have spiral arms or not. It doesn't make a lot of difference.
Just two very quick comments. One is that in the supernova remnant scenario, the calculation that you were saying that, of course, was needed has been done by Sarkar et al., and it seems like titanium over iron is in perfect agreement. Boron over carbon is somewhat in agreement, but there is, the error bars are large. And in any case, as you should know, that calculation is way more model-dependent than the electron or positron calculation. The other comment is very general. It's nice to go into the fine structure and see if you expect features and so on, but one should keep in mind that all these models of dark matter that we're talking about produce a huge amount of antiprotons, which are not observed, and so some ingredient that you have to put by hands in all these things is this leptophilic, ugly word, leptophilic dark matter, which there is no reason for exist but to explain the Pamela data. It's something that you that people invented in order to fit just this very single piece of information. And it's something that we should keep in mind. And once you give up, of course, the fact that this might be WIMPs, all the bets are off in terms of the injection spectrum. So, of course, there's a huge uncertainty in your calculations.
The leptophilic models actually give you, for all those constraints on dark matter that I just described, a lower limit. If you put in any other particle that comes on top of that, all the limits are much more severe. So if you already, produce trouble for dark matter, even with the leptophilics, then this is the strongest constraint you can get. Okay, so you don't need anything beyond, if it's already dead, right? You don't need to shoot the horse again. It wasn't already dead because people were talking about the leptophilic models for quite some time, actually longer than this 1 year.
Okay, I think so.